Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the tiny country of Guyana, which is the fastest growing economy in the world. But will newfound oil reserves be a windfall or their downfall? Curious? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Radio Tehran.
Мы не вторгались на территорию Украины.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 26th of March. A bridge in the US port of Baltimore collapses after being hit by a cargo ship. At least four vehicles plunge into the water and seven people are missing. Turkey arrests nearly 150 Islamist suspects following the deadly attack on a concert hall in Russia. And why adults rather than babies are becoming the main market for nappies or diapers in Japan. Also in the podcast, Venezuela's opposition suffers another setback in efforts to challenge the autocratic president in this year's election. Dramatic footage emerges of a raid at the home of US rapper Sean Diddy Combs. And
it did give the right instructions of how to make it. What it didn't tell me was all of the kind of tips that I would add in.
Would you trust artificial intelligence in the kitchen? It is one of America's busiest ports, handling cargo from around the world. But today, Baltimore is closed to shipping after a major bridge collapsed into the water. Webcam footage from the port of Baltimore overnight showed a container ship hitting one of the bridge supports just before 1:30 a.m. A 300-metre section of road then collapses into the Patapsco River, along with at least four vehicles. A nearby resident heard the vessel collide with the bridge.
I wanted to know what the bang was. Ship hit the Key Bridge, sinking. The bridge is gone. Holy hell.
The Baltimore Fire Chief, James Wallace, says they're still searching for people in the water.
At about 01:50 hours, our first unit arrived on scene and reported a complete collapse of the Key Bridge. We were also given information that there were likely multiple people on the bridge at the time of the collapse and that, as a result, multiple people were in the water.
Well, the city's mayor, Brandon Scott, spoke of his shock at seeing the bridge come down.
This is a tragedy that you can never imagine. I was awake when Chief Wallace called me, but never would you think that you would physically see the Key Bridge tumble down like that. It looked like something out of an action movie. And you just think about, most importantly, which is what we all should be thinking about right now, nothing but those families and people that are impacted and those people who are risking their lives right now from not just Baltimore City and Baltimore County, but all over the state to try to save lives.
Well, the governor of the state of Maryland has declared a state of emergency. Not long after dawn broke in Baltimore, I got the latest from our correspondent there, Tom Bateman.
I'm standing at the moment on the east side of the harbour and we're looking across to this scene of destruction. I can see the Singapore flagged container vessel and it is a really unbelievable image of destruction. This cantilever bridge that is just twisted and wrecked and two huge sort of triangular shapes of the wreckage now pointing out from the water. Away from the centre point of the bridge, completely collapsed. And the ship itself just stuck there. A bit of smoke appears to be rising either from it, close to it, or behind it. And in the water now, there are divers searching for what the fire authorities have described as potentially around 7 people they fear are missing. And now this urgent recovery and rescue work goes on.
I'm looking at footage shot from the air. You can see the nose of that vessel in the wreckage of the bridge. It is a big ship, and inevitably, if it had hit any part of the bridge, it would have come down. Do we know what went wrong?
What's available from both the marine tracking websites and also that live stream video of the moments where the ship hit the bridge itself. So on the first point, it appeared that the ship was docked. It then turned in the water and made a very short journey in the minutes before it struck the bridge. Now, you can see this from the live stream video. All of the lights and the power appear to be on the ship. About 3 minutes before it hits that support pillar, the ship goes completely dark. Now, some of them appear to come back on about a couple of minutes before it makes impact, but it then is what appears to be drifting. It turns slightly in the water. It takes about 2 minutes before it makes impact, and there's a cloud of what I imagine is dust and masonry that emanates from the support pillar as it strikes the bridge. The other thing to say about that moment is you can see in the minutes before it hits the bridge, there is traffic on the bridge, the trucks, and you can see the headlights of larger vehicles anyway, a few minutes beforehand. At the moment it makes impact, you can't see visibly any traffic apparent on the bridge. Now, the fire service have said that they believe there's a tractor trailer or a truck, they say, in the water. We don't know if there's more than that. There were certainly reports that there could be more vehicles in the water.
Tom Bateman in Baltimore. Well, after I spoke to him, US officials confirmed that the Singapore flag vessel Dali had lost propulsion as it was leaving Baltimore Harbor. The crew notified the State Department of Transportation that they'd lost control of the vessel before the collision. Construction crews were working on the bridge at the time. And we'll return to this story before the end of the podcast. Turkey says nearly 150 people linked to so-called Islamic State have been detained in a series of raids across the country. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, promised to work with Russia following Friday's attack in Moscow, which has been claimed by IS. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, told us more about the security operation in Turkey.
147 suspects have been detained, and the Interior Minister, Ali Yerlikaya, has put this in the context of wider raids against Islamic State. Now, obviously, Turkey has its long-standing problems with the Islamic State militant group, having suffered numerous attacks, including recently in January, an attack on a church in Istanbul. The Interior Minister says that 2,900 people have been detained since June of last year, with a number of things seized, foreign currency, documents and digital materials. And he says that Turkey is engaged in fighting terrorism 365 days of the year. On the specifics of the four suspected perpetrators of the Moscow attack, all of them are Tajik, Turkey's state broadcaster reported on Monday that two of the four had been recently in Turkey. One of them, Faridun Shamsiddin, who's suspected to be the ringleader, was in a hotel in Istanbul between the end of February and the beginning of March. Another, Sayyid Akram Rajab Alizodar, arrived in Istanbul in January and returned on the same flight as Faridun Shamsiddin. So Turkish security sources have told the paper that it was too short a time for them to have been radicalised in Turkey. They contend that they were radicalised in Russia, but there are long-standing links in Turkey with Islamic State groups, including the Khorasan group linked to the Moscow attacks.
And I was talking to Danny Eberhard there. The rights of Venezuelans are being denied, the words of the woman hoping to challenge the country's long-term president, Nicolas Maduro. Corina Yoris, the opposition's latest figurehead, says she's been blocked from standing in the upcoming election. The 80-year-old said she'd exhausted all possibilities to file her application, but insisted the constitution had to be respected.
I'm not anyone's substitute. We're in a transitional period and the deadline for registering candidates must be respected. You know that we will not deviate from the electoral route, nor will we bypass the constitution.
So what does this all mean for politics in Venezuela? I heard from our Latin America editor, Vanessa Buschluter.
This means that the woman who had a chance of beating President Maduro if, and this is a big if, the elections were free and fair, has now been eliminated. She is not able to stand at this moment. Of course, her coalition of opposition parties will try and circumvent this and still get her on the ticket. But as it stands now, she will not be standing for election. Corina Yoris is an unknown even in opposition circles. She was only nominated by her party on Friday because the real candidate, Maria Corina Machado, who had gotten more than 90% in opposition primary, was barred by the Supreme Court from standing for 15 years for office. So Maria Corina Machado tried everything to stand herself. And when that wasn't possible, she chose this 80-year-old academic because she is somebody that the government couldn't find any fault with. There's no corruption scandals that have tainted her. Because she's such an unknown, there's nothing that they could pin on her. And that was why she was chosen.
And yet they still managed to stop her. As it stands, does it look like Nicolas Maduro will get another term in office?
Very much so. Unless, like I said, there is free and fair elections. And I don't think that Maduro and his administration will allow that. There seems to be every chance that Nicolas Maduro will serve a third term until 2031.
Vanessa Buschluter, our Latin America's editor. Nappies or diapers are an essential piece of kit for new parents. But the low birth rate in Japan has prompted one manufacturer to move away from making them for babies and instead is turning to the adult market, as I heard from our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton.
This really is symbolic of how things are changing rapidly in Japan, Oliver. You know, back in 2016, that's really the first time that we learned that more adult diapers or nappies were being sold in Japan than diapers or nappies that were made for babies. That was one indication of how the birth rate was falling. Now that's changed so much. That whole trend has continued to such a degree that one of the biggest makers of those products, OG Holdings, has decided it's just not worth making infant diapers or nappies anymore, that they should just stop doing it. And instead, they're going to be making them for other markets around the world where populations are growing, where lots of babies are being born, but they're not going to bother to make any more for babies being born inside Japan because the birth rate has fallen so much.
Yeah, just one example of the impact. What else is it affecting, this low birth rate?
Oh, lots of things. I mean, Japan life has changed so much just in the past 20 years, really. You know, one third of the population is over the age of 65. That's why so many things in Japan are talking about pensions, talking about nursing homes. Less than 12% of the population is under the age of 15. So we regularly hear about schools closing down because they simply don't have enough students. You know, the birth rate is just so low that it really has shifted daily life in Japan.
Yeah, the government doesn't seem to have made any impact on trying to change that. Where is Japan going?
Well, it's so bad that the Prime Minister just a month ago said that the falling birth rate is Japan's biggest crisis. One of the main people in his cabinet followed that up by saying that they think the country really has just 6 years to try to reverse the trend. And a lot of the focus has been to try to encourage married couples who already have children to opt to have even more children. Most young people say that they simply don't feel that they have the career prospects. They don't have the ability to move into a place that could allow them to have a family. So it's a much bigger systemic problem than just a lack of parents wanting to have two, three or four children.
Celia Hatton. Next to one of hip-hop's biggest stars.
Let's rock. You digging my style, my swag, my sway, my swerve. My way with words the boys observe for sure. You can't fault on my aura called them.
Sean Diddy Combs. The singer has hit the headlines yet again after his homes in LA and Miami were raided by Homeland Security agents. Officials say it's part of a federal sex trafficking investigation. Our North America correspondent David Willis spoke to Nick Qureshi.
Aerial footage shows dozens of federal agents, some of them armed, dressed in tactical gear, swarming the Los Angeles mansion home of Sean Combs. It's a sprawling, massive property in the upmarket enclave of Holmby Hills, as it's known here. That's an area where several other leading celebrities have a home. And the pictures also showed several people on a grass verge outside the property in handcuffs whilst the agents searched the premises. A simultaneous operation also involving dozens of agents was mounted at a home in Miami that is also associated with Sean Combs. Details of the search warrant, though, haven't been released, but it is, as you mentioned there, being reported here that this was all part of a federal sex trafficking investigation, although there's no word on whether Sean Combs himself is the target of that investigation. His whereabouts are currently unknown, but there are unconfirmed reports that federal agents in Florida seized his phones shortly before he was due to leave for a trip to the Caribbean.
All right, well, we'll see what happens there, David. A number of cases, though, aren't there, pending against Sean Combs?
There are, and he is, of course, one of the biggest names in hip-hop music, 3 times a Grammy winner, also the founder of his own fashion company, his own television network. But last November, his former girlfriend, the R&B vocalist Cassie Ventura, filed a lawsuit against him, amongst other things, accusing him of domestic violence and sex trafficking. And she also claimed in that lawsuit that he had plied her with drugs and alcohol at various times. Now, the case was settled out of court, but it paved the way to civil lawsuits on the part of 2 other women who also accused P. Diddy of grooming and sexually assaulting them back in the early 1990s. And then in December, another woman came forward to accuse him and 2 other men of raping her when she was just 17 years old. And then last month, a male music producer filed a lawsuit in New York accusing Sean Combs of groping and sexually assaulting him. Mr. Combs has denied all the allegations against him, and one of his lawyers indeed referred to them as complete lies.
David Willis in California. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Those hops are vital to the British pint, but without that, we're just going to be importing beer.
Saving the great British pint from the threat of climate change.
Water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the tiny country of Guyana, which is the fastest growing economy in the world. But will newfound oil reserves be a windfall or their downfall? Curious? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Israel has a history of ignoring UN resolutions, so it's little surprise that the Security Council's demand for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza on Monday hasn't been met. The UN resolution also called for the unconditional release of all the hostages held by Hamas and other Palestinian groups. That hasn't happened either. Early on Tuesday, Israel carried out new airstrikes and pursued operations in cities in the north and south of the Strip. Leo Cairns is the head of mission for Médecins Sans Frontières in Gaza. He's been talking to Rob Young.
Even today, after nearly 6 months of war, the hospitals are under attack more than ever. In Shifa Hospital, it's completely invaded by the Israeli army. The hospital is not functional. The patients have not access to healthcare. We wanted to go 3 days ago to Nasser Hospital. We were denied access by the Israeli army because of military operation in the area. In Al-Amal Hospital, it's exactly the same. What is going on is that there is military operation nearby the hospital. One people have been sniped inside Al-Amal Hospital, and the people couldn't evacuate. 2 days ago from the hospital. So we see a pattern of systematic attack on the hospital. Today, to be a healthcare worker in Gaza is the most dangerous job ever. And I think it's sad and it should be revolting. It's unacceptable that healthcare workers once more are being the main victim.
The Israeli Defense Forces say that Hamas gunmen are firing at troops from Al-Shifa Hospital, from the emergency room and from the maternity ward, among others. If they weren't there, the Israeli Defense Forces might not be launching an operation around the hospital.
Yeah, you know, I think IHL is very clear. Hospitals should not be used as a military purpose. Any side have to respect the hospital. We have been seeing direct shooting at hospital, including Shifa Hospital, including Nasser Hospital. So, yes, we are calling for all warring parties to respect the hospital. It is basic IHL. But what we see since the beginning of the war is that a systematic military operation directed to all the major hospitals. And then on top of this, we are seeing mass arrest of medical people. Many medical people, healthcare personnel, has been arrested either within the hospital or while trying to leave the hospital. And when they are arrested, some of them are deported to Israel and we have no news about them. It's a complete blackout. We have no information whatsoever about what's happening to them.
Leo Kahn from the medical charity MSF in Gaza. A former chairman of China's Football Association has been sentenced to life in prison for taking bribes. The charges against Chen Shuyuwen and a number of other officials are part of a wider crackdown on corruption in the game. Mark Dreyer is a journalist and expert in Chinese football. He told James Menendez about the convictions.
Chen Shuyuan is one of about close to a dozen senior Chinese sporting officials, mostly involved with football, but also other sports, that have been found guilty. And a lot of the sentences were handed out today. So this is an investigation that's been going on for about 18 months or more at this point. We knew that they were going to be found guilty. That was revealed about a month or so ago, but the sentences have been made official today. Chen has a 15-year sentence. He has been accused of taking bribery, about $11 million worth in total. Some of the other officials have similar offences. A lot of it is bribery and corruption. That's the gist of this wider investigation.
And what does it tell us about the way that football in China operates?
About a decade or so ago, there was a big match-fixing scandal, and that ensnared, you know, a whole bunch of players and managers and referees and officials. And then things seemed to be better. There were the boom years where the Chinese Super League were attracting a lot of some of the top footballers, including from the Premier League and some of the top talents around the world. And then things started to take a bit of a turn for the worse. And this is the writing at the end of this chapter of a dark period of Chinese football. Is it necessarily going to change the fact that people at the top have been removed? Well, to be honest, I'm not so sure. I think it's more of a systemic issue than just a handful of bad apples that have been found. I have to say, this is not specific to football. Things have definitely got better. I think you have to say that. But the fact that corruption is still rife, perhaps is too strong a word, but it's still very much present in certain sectors, football being one example. Clearly, there's still lots more to be done, even if the situation is better than it was a decade ago.
Is there a feeling amongst the Chinese leadership in the Communist Party that China, in terms of football, isn't performing perhaps as well as it should, given the leadership's ambitions for the country, if I can put it like that?
Well, very much so. I mean, there was a slightly farcical situation in the last few days where the captain of the Chinese national team, Jian Linpeng, who was once rumoured to be sought after by Chelsea, he resigned after a disgraceful performance, as he called it. The team was 2-0 up against Singapore, and then they ended up drawing 2-2. And then a few days later, he said he changed his mind. So clearly they didn't even let him resign. The state of Chinese football has just been abysmal. And I think the fans know it, the officials know it, the leadership know it, of course. China is a top-down country and everything comes from the top, whereas football really to flourish needs a bottoms-up or a grassroots approach. And it's that contradiction that I think is holding football back in China.
Chinese football expert Mark Dreyer. Britain is famous for its pubs and the beer served within, with bitter perhaps the most famous example. But now scientists fear climate change could call time on the Great British Pint as a result of its impact on the hops plant. So they've sprung into action to help the brewing industry, as I heard from our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh.
British bitter is very much part of the culture in the UK, but the issue is actually a worldwide issue because hops are used in all beers wherever it's brewed. And across the world, hop production has plummeted over the decades because of the hotter, drier conditions that have become increasingly more frequent over the years. One study found in parts of Europe, hop production had dropped by 20%. And also it's having an effect on the taste. The acids that give that bitter taste, particularly to bitter, which people in the UK love, has actually gone down. And it has to be specific to countries because the genetics vary from variety to variety that's grown in different parts of the world. Scientists in the UK are looking at the various varieties of hops that are used in beer making in the country and searching through all the genes and looking for genes that will make varieties drought resistant, disease resistant, but also finding the genes for flavour so that in 5 years' time, when they've done their genetic searches, hop breeders will be able to breed new varieties that are both climate resistant and also more flavoursome much more quickly.
So what, it'll taste even better?
It's not so much even better. Fashions change. These days, certainly in the UK, possibly worldwide, some consumers want punchier, stronger flavours. And that's been dealt with in the UK by importing American hops to add to the mix. But what they'd really like to do, and which should be better for the environment, is to grow those punchier flavoured hops in the UK. There's also citrusy flavours, which younger people like. And also, what they hope to do is to kind of have this library of flavours to identify flavours that people don't like yet, but might like in the future. Amazing.
Pallab Ghosh, our science correspondent. Artificial intelligence is everywhere these days, disrupting everything from work and education to entertainment. But can we trust it when it comes to something like food? AI cookbooks are now all over the internet, but do the recipes really stack up? Alfie Habershon has been investigating.
It's probably time to admit that ChatGPT simply knows better. Summarising that long novel that we never quite got round to reading, or writing that university essay in a matter of seconds, it's effortless, even if some find it a bit threatening. But is there one part of life where it just can't quite match us? Because what does a chatbot really know when it comes to the pleasures of eating? Well, AI cookbooks are now flooding the internet with new recipes, but understandably, many of us are a bit wary to try them. Professional chef Clodagh McKenna has been experimenting with an AI recipe for an American breakfast classic, Eggs Benedict.
I'm just taking the poached eggs out of my saucepan. They're coming out perfectly. The hollandaise sauce is lovely and fluffy and just as I would like it. It did give the right instructions of how to make it. What it didn't tell me was all of the kind of tips that I would add in, because making hollandaise sauce can so easily go wrong. It can scramble. So I would have added in, if you see your eggs beginning to scramble, take them off the heat and whisk in vigorously some hot water. And the other thing with the poached eggs, you know, it's very, very basic. It's like pop them into a ramekin and then straight into the saucepan. But it did not tell me to swirl the water, which is key.
But it's not just the taste that's at stake here. Like the best chefs, AI has an experimental spirit when it comes to cooking. But that's not always a good thing when it comes to unintended results like mosquito-repellent roast potatoes or bleach-infused rice surprise. And it gets even weirder when it comes to the images. Looking at two-tailed shrimps and hot dog stir-fries might not only threaten our skills in the kitchen, but also our appetites. But the biggest problem might be that cooking is about a human sense of trust in our favourite chefs, a tough place for robots to muscle in on the action. But AI is certainly trying to make its mark.
That report by Alfie Habershon. Returning now to our top story, the search for people in the water in the port of Baltimore after a bridge collapsed when it was hit by a container ship in the early hours. The owner of the Dali, which sails under a Singaporean flag, say all crew members, including the two pilots on board, have been accounted for. Our business reporter in Singapore, Katie Silver, has been talking to the vessel's owners.
The shipping company Synergy Marine Group, it's got about 668 vessels around the world. The official spokesperson for the company told me that it was an all-Indian crew, about 22 people on board. They've also told us that two members of the company's US team are currently en route to Baltimore to investigate from both Miami and Oklahoma, and that it was indeed unusual to have an incident like this, given that there were these two pilots on board. It's also a particularly popular port when it comes to car shipments, which, as you can imagine, are a thing
going to be big vessels like this one, which was about 300 metres. Now, one Singapore-based shipping expert I spoke with said that there's a very extensive departure checklist that these vessels have to go through before they leave ports. And he said if everything was done, then something was clearly overlooked. We're also already seeing the impact when it comes to shipping. So another expert, for example, has been telling the BBC that it's going to create significant problems on the US East Coast for both importers and exporters. Already, we know, for example, about 21,000 units of cargo are going to need to be diverted. Many vessels all but trapped in the port because of this disruption. And in fact, 10 commercial ships who are heading to Baltimore have already dropped their anchors. This is going to come with delays, added costs for the region, although it's unlikely really that we're going to see a significant global impact when it comes to the shipping industry.
Our Singapore business reporter, Katie Silver. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Muzetchka and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the tiny country of Guyana, which is the fastest growing economy in the world. But will newfound oil reserves be a windfall or their downfall? Curious? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.